Very good. Good. So again, welcome to, what day is it? Sunday today. So the third day of this meditation retreat. Sometimes it's nice to tell the video what day the retreat is on, because if they get it all mixed up, but he's saying from the very beginning that this is talk number 3. And I did mention in passing yesterday about things like Anapanasati, talked a little bit about just learning how to relax and be kind to yourself. And to reinforce that message on how to meditate, I think it's the right time for me now to start talking about a way to understand the stages of meditation without regarding them as things to achieve. So sometimes you have to be very careful, because when you start talking about stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4, people always feel either frustrated that they haven't got to that stage yet, or they feel proud. Look how far I have come. Or they get blocked because the very trying to achieve something sort of stops the process of meditation. And, okay, let's do this one, this little story. Okay, I think, Ananda, are you? Okay, come on, you've done this one before, so you can be my assistant. You know what's coming up. So, for those who haven't seen or heard this before, it's an important visual exercise, an example to understand what meditation is, how it works. This is the idea that samadhi means stillness, and we use the example of water because that is a very powerful metaphor for the mind. You know, it's not just Buddhist, it's was it Joseph Campbell's Myths and Symbols. Water and the mind is really, really very connected together, in the sense that it they do match in many synonyms or metaphors. So the job is to have this water in my cup come to perfect stillness. Now, Ananda, if you will, because Ananda is the right person for this simile, because you're named after the Buddha's chief disciple. Not that I'm the Buddha, but just... So, is this water still?
No, John.
You know why? Because I'm paying no attention. So now I will be mindful. Has it stopped moving yet?
No, John, not yet.
Okay, so I'll concentrate. Put forth effort, come on. Yeah. Did you notice, I noticed this, that when I put forth effort, it actually moves more. Interesting, isn't it? So, many people, they try and be more skillful, get their effort, and just like, come and hold still. Any sort of medical doctors know that, you know, the arm, the muscles are always metabolizing. They're always moving. You can't keep a muscle still, unless it's dead. So, how can I keep this water perfectly still? You put it down, let it go, and you're patient. You asked about patience. Yes, so just wait, don't interfere. And then after a few moments, still moving. Sit now.
Well, almost.
Yeah, okay. Do a bit more. How's that?
Well, it's perfect. Huh?
There we go. Very good. Thank you, Ananda. He's done this before. Letting go is the cause of stillness. And patience is also important. So you put it down and you think, still yet? Nope. Still yet? No, not yet. When are you going to be still? Come on. But I haven't got all day, you know. Come on. There's only 7 days of the retreat left. Come on. So, you let it down, you put it down. That is the cause of stillness. So, stillness is like the goal, but you don't achieve that goal through striving, through holding. And too many people, you know, I've come across, they say they've been meditating for months, for years, and they just can't do it. And they really, you know, disciplined, and they have put lots of effort into it, lots of time, and still don't get still. So, this is the reason. So, to give it an even more complete description, which allows me to take this simile into far, far more refined and illustrative examples, that I developed the simile of the thousand petal lotus. It's a wonderful little vehicle for describing meditation process. What happens, how it works, what the problems are. So I know that several of you have heard this many times, but in the evening I hear the same old questions every time. So because of that, you're going to get the same old stories every time. That's true, you know. If you really understand this, then, yeah, off you go, you just be enlightened. So, the thousand petal lotus, a lotus is a plant, a flower, which closes up its petals in the night time. And if you go and look at one of those outermost petals of the lotus, it is not that beautiful. It is serrated, rough, maybe a bit dusty because it has to take all the storms and the winds and the dust. That's why it's thick, because it's protecting what's inside. And in the early morning, the sun rises, unless you're in England during the winter time when it's all grey. But in the places where lotuses grow, the sun rises and the first light and warmth of the sun hits the outermost petal of the lotus. The outermost petal starts to open up because of the light and the warmth of the sun. And that reveals the next layer of petals inside the outermost sheath. And that next layer of petals is still thick, but it's got some colour. It actually looks like a petal. It's thick. It's got some sort of fragrance to it, but not very much. But it allows now the sun to shine on that next layer of petals so that can open up, revealing the third layer of petals so that can open up. And then the fourth layer, the fifth, all these different stages of petals. They open up one after the other, only because when the previous one has opened up, it allows the light and the warmth of the sun to strike the one which is now to be opened up. And the deeper you go, the more beautiful are those petals, the more fragrant they are, and also the more delicate they are. And the lotus opens up, petal by petal by petal. And how does it open up? Just the warmth and the light of the sun. Now in that simile, the warmth and the light of the sun stands for kindness and awareness, mindfulness. Going together as kindfulness. And you know that sometimes it's quite reassuring that apparently I was just checking with disciples over in Hong Kong with Gerald, that it was coined by me in a restaurant in Hong Kong somewhere where we're talking about the Dhamma and mindfulness. And just the thing I saw missing more than anything else in mindfulness training with some kindness. And to have the kindness and mindfulness become kindfulness, and just the scene, just checking out websites and books, it's made an impact and it is coming in as an important part of mindfulness training, you know, in just our modern world. So that kindfulness is how the lotus opens up. And what is the lotus? Your body and mind. That needs to be opened up. And I don't mean with a scalpel. I know that my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, that somebody was looking for it in the bookshop in Adelaide. And they went to the, you know, the usual section of religion, self-help. They could not find it. So they asked at the counter, and it was, you know, built on a computer. It was in the shop, and they found it in the medical section, surgery. It's a true story. Someone looked, opening the door of your heart, and they put it in heart surgery section. If it can happen, it does happen. But anyway, to open you out so you can see what's inside the body, what's inside all these different stages. To do that, you do need just simple mindfulness and kindness. That's all. So, what happens, and this is another very useful and inspiring part of this simile. There's many people who have come here who I thought, no way they should be able to meditate. I looked upon them on the outside, their outermost petal, which was far too rough. And of course, the classic example was a few years ago. This fellow came, he was big, bushy haired, and had tattoos over him. You know, just, you know, thongs and a singlet, whatever. And as soon as he came in, I was by the office while they were taking registrations. And I looked at him and stereotyped him. There's, you know, just the wrong thing to do, but I make mistakes many times as well. And I said, sir, this is a Buddhist retreat center. The prison farm is 6 kilometers up the road. Because they're prison up the road. Because that's what he looked like. He didn't look like he belonged here, you know, just, you know, stupid Ajahn Brahm. But then he said, look, no, I've registered. I said, really? And his name was there, okay. I admit my mistake, sorry. But he's not the sort of person that, you know, that you'd usually see in it. They're always welcome, but seemed a bit out of place. But in the interviews, this reason I tell the story was number one, you can't judge a person. You know, sometimes we do, and we pay for it afterwards. But I paid with a bit of humiliation because he came into the interviews and started describing his meditation. And wow, he got jhanas, real ones. I can confirm that. I know people just, you know, say, oh, this must be jhana, isn't it? Wasn't it? Please, wasn't it? Please. Well, you can never tell. Oh, thank you. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm's confirmed. I've got chance. But that was really sort of, and the reason it really was pleased me but surprised me was in the retreat, he was probably the last person I would have picked to get a jhana. And there he got it. And that really told you, just you have these outermost petals of the lotus. You just don't know what's inside. Angulimala, serial killer. Another good, you know, you look at the outermost, a serial killer, what's he going to do getting jhanas? No way. But inside every lotus, the outside might be rough and dirty and stained, but inside every lotus, it is beautiful petals. That's you. So number one, it gives you like the inspiration. Yes, it can be done. And in my life, I've seen some people who are just, wow, you know, that you did that? Wow, amazing. And I'd also point out that if you come and ask me about your experiences, apparently people have done research, and they listed sort of the five toughest examiners for Samadhi. So, so number five. Now this is saying, now these people, they know it's not that hard to pass a Samadhi test with them. So you know, if I think it was the number five was Ayakama. If she says you have jhanas, you know that's you know the standards aren't as high. But Par Oksayadaw, he was number two. It's really tough to be confirmed that you had a jhana with Par Oksayadaw. But number one, Ajahn Brahm. Because if I tell you to say you have a jhana, I mean it really is a high bar. I think that's just the bar the Buddha set. But nevertheless, so if I said this fellow had a jhana, all the other you know, great teachers, they would have confirmed it too. Person who looked more like a bikey, a Hell's Angel, and he got these jhanas. So if he can, you certainly can. So, it gives you the encouragement. Now you know it can be done. You can go to the deepest parts of meditation, each one here. How does it happen? Now, you may have noticed I was very careful. I did not say, how do you do it? How does it happen? You can't do it. It happens when you establish mindfulness and kindness. Not just mindfulness, the warmth as well. What do you mean by kindness? Opening the door of your heart to this moment. This beautiful, you might call it unconditional mindfulness. Mindfulness which does not expect anything, which can enjoy, love the little teddy bear which you're cuddling. Unconditional kindness. It's the kindness which actually binds you to the object. The glue which makes your attention stick to something. Because it's pleasant. It's the right type of delight when it's kindness happens. So, mindfulness and kindness. You start with the outermost petal of your body, of your lotus, which is your body. And sometimes people look, oh, old. Bent over, can't see, can't hear, can't walk properly, old, it does not matter. Your body is just the outermost sheath. Inside, what's going on? Anyone who saw Stephen Hawking would never think such an amazing mind was inside that outermost sheath called his body. Just like you. Inside. But how do you get inside? So first of all, you're mindful of your body. And you are kind to her. Poor little body. You know, do you want to put your feet out? Do you want to lean back or lean forward? You find a comfortable position for your body. You're kind, you're aware of it. And you look at any parts of the body which are a bit tight and relax it. You have enough food not to actually to get stuffed up and feel tired because of overeating, not so you get sort of stomach ache, not so you feel weak. This is middle way. So it feels energized and comfortable. Well, the Buddha said, all feelings of hunger just disappear, and for new feelings of overeating or indigestion, so they don't come up. So the body is tranquil. And It's tough getting the body tranquil, but after a while you can feel it. Relax it, relax this, relax that, move, scratch. Should always tell about coughing. If you need to cough, please do it as quickly as possible. Thank you. And the reason is what we call volcano effect. And I've seen this so many times in these retreats and meditation sessions which I've led. Someone is there and they've got irritable throat, so no, instead of just coughing, they decide, no, I'm not going to cough, I'll disturb somebody. So the irritation builds and builds. I'm not going to cough. No. I can express it. It builds. And then eventually, just like a volcano plugged up, eventually it blows. It has to. It's nature. And when it does, and all the kangaroos run away. People hear it over in Bodhinyana Monastery. And that's like the explosion. But worse than that, just like, you know, people have to have evacuation zones around volcanoes because all that toxic fumes and dust, that can kill you. It's poisonous. So just before you cough, you have to evacuate all the people around you because all that stuff coming out of your mouth, uncontrolled, that can spread a long way. It's not very nice. So, please, just cough. And then it doesn't have to work. Okay, that's just kindness and wisdom. So, you look after your body, first of all. It's another reason why I've encouraged and still encourage some of you, if you need to rest, rest. Go to your bedroom, lay down, have a nap. Even though you should have by now caught up with a lot of your sleep deficit, sometimes you may not have. But nevertheless, several times during interviews, fourth, fifth, sixth day of the meditation retreat, people have come to me and said, look, I'm getting nowhere, it's just really frustrating, please help. And I say to them, go to your room and lay down and have a sleep. And no, I can't do that. I've slept enough already in the first few days. Go to your room, get on your bed and have a sleep. But no, that isn't. Look! Go to your room, lay down and have a nap. Don't set the alarm clock. Just whenever you get up and then just have a shower, something to drink, and then come and meditate. And you know, 100% success rate. At least those who come and tell me. And those if they didn't have its success, I may be in denial, I've blocked it out of my mind that sometimes it doesn't work, but so many times it works. Why? Because you're relaxing your body. Your body's far too tense. It reminds me, because it is, I'll tell you why I tell this story, about the man who went to the psychologist. And he said to them, I can't really quite figure it out because sometimes, you know, it's like I imagine I am a wigwam, a wigwam, you know, like the old teepees which the Indians used to use. Sometimes it's like I'm a wigwam. He said, and other times I feel I'm a marquee. And the psychologist thought and said, I know that syndrome. You're too tense. It is April Fool's Day, come on. Okay. So if you're tense, of course you can't do anything. So you relax your body and you can feel it relaxing. How do you relax your body? Mindfulness. And kindness. Mindfulness, you know, shows you where the problems are. And kindness, once you learn it, it releases the tightness, it lessens the tension. Lots of old Well, I first learned this, many of you probably learned this as well, you know, when you were a little kid. And I used to play soccer in the streets and always were falling over and scraping the skin off my knees because, you know, it was in the street or in the asphalt road. And when you went for a tackle, you know, that's what happened. So I remember just my knees always having scabs on them, you know, like dried blood while the thing was healing underneath. And of course, being a young kid, you know, you just cried and you ran to your mummy, mummy. And then she would kneel down and she would kiss it. You called it kissing it better. And it worked every time. As soon as she put her mouth full of germs on that open wound, the pain went away and the thing healed. And of course, I thought that was normal. And then later on, if you're in a hospital and you see the nurses coming up, someone is just being kind to you. That just takes a lot of pain away. So just kindness is a huge, powerful therapy. It relaxes you. So, if you are kind to your body, the body heals, it relaxes, and you get this beautiful state of the delight in just a relaxed body. No tightness, no tension. The body is at ease. That's why the Buddha, before he sat under the Bodhi tree, he, good bath, nice food, food that was made for a heavenly being, from Sujata. He got this milk rice pudding, and gave it to the Buddha because it was prepared for like a heavenly being. And where did he sit? Was it out in the open on broken grass? It was under a nice shady tree, a Bodhi tree, by a river, in a garden, in a park. That's what Bodh Gaya was like. Uruwela, we called before. No, not Uruwela, it was, forget what it's called now, but it's by the river Nirantula. And these days, you know, there's not much water flowing in that river. It's a bit dirty and too many people. Imagine what it would have been like so many years ago. The big river and just a nice little garden, few trees. It'd be like a paradise. That's where the Buddha sat. He didn't sit on the hard ground. Because at a root of a tree, if you've seen fig trees, imagine putting your bottom on those roots all the time. You know, you get a sore bottom in just about 10 or 15 minutes. He got grass to spread it out so it's nice and comfortable. The first Zafu, meditation cushion from grass. Comfortable, nice breeze, and not too many mosquitoes, if any. That was the place the Buddha became enlightened. It could relax the body. Now that's really important message. First stage of meditation is a relaxed body. Because if you can relax your body through mindfulness and kindness, then the body is not a problem anymore. When it's not a problem or a disturbance, it's not a distraction, and the body, you can go actually inside of it, like inside the lotus. So your mind, your emotional world, if the body is aching or hurting, that will take precedence over anything else. But if the body is relaxed, you go inside the outermost layer, opened up, and you go into your emotional world. That's where I started working on the peaceometer. But really, what you're doing on the peaceometer, to make it very calm and peaceful, you find it's the past and the future. That is the biggest irritation, pain, ache, disturbance of your emotional, mental world. It's the next thing which usually will come up once you go inside the body. So this is the next layer of petals. Time. How can you go into the center of time, the present moment? Now, of course, many people have made fortunes over the power of now. But you can see that in places like Bhadeka Rasa Sutta of the Buddha, how it's important to actually to come into this present moment. But how does that happen? How can you destroy the past and the future? Obliterate it. Get rid of it. Of course you can't. That whole idea of using energy or force, suppression, never ever works. It just makes these things worse. So what do you use? Mindfulness and kindness. Be kind to your memories of the past. Soften them first of all. And then they can disappear. If you don't have any kindness, that person did it, that B-A-S-T-R-D did something else, no, be kind. Whatever they were doing or saying, they probably had, thought they were doing something good. They were just beings in this world with their defilements. And what do you expect? So this is just human beings. So let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Yes, I may have said something nasty, but maybe that I just misheard them. Or maybe they were in the bad mood. Just like that classic story of the husband who had the afternoon off work. And his wife said, "Darling, I need some eggs for dinner tonight. Would you mind going to the market and getting me some eggs?" "Certainly, darling," he said, "but I've never been there before. Please, give me some instructions." So she wrote a little map out, gave him some money in the basket, off he went, happily to help his darling wife. And so he was walking there to the market, just, enjoying the free afternoon, doing something to help. And as soon as he entered the market, this young man, maybe about 17 or 18, came right up to him and said, "You are so ugly," said to this husband. "You look like a camel. The backside of a camel, that is. And I don't know what type of aftershave you've been using, but it also smells like what comes out of the backside of a dog." And so it's very hard for me to actually to think of new words of abuse. Because I am a monk, and I'm a very sensitive monk. And when people abuse you, just don't listen. But you know that in this world there's so many different ways of abusing another person. And so this young man went on and on about him. And the husband was first of all, shocked. I never met this fellow before. Now why is he getting upset at me and angry at me for? I've never done anything. Not my fault. And it's in public, humiliating me in front of everybody. It's really unfair. And so the poor husband got more and more embarrassed, more and more upset. He turned around and went home. And as soon as he came in, people do when they're upset, slammed the door. And the wife said, "Oh, you're home early, darling. You got the eggs." "No! Never send me to that stupid market again. It's a terrible place. People are just so unfriendly and just uncivilized. You wouldn't know what this person called me." And at the end of that tirade, even sort of angry people have to pause for breath every now and again. And so the wife said, "Darling, what did that man look like?" And when he described this young man to his wife, "Oh, it's him. That man had an accident when he was very young. He hit his head on the floor. He's brain damaged. But he says those things to me, or even worse to me. He says it to everybody. We all know that he's brain damaged. And he can never go to school, will never get a job or find a nice partner to share his life with. And we all know that. He just hangs around the market all day. It's swearing at people, saying bad things, but poor fella. It's just brain damage, that's all. And as soon as the husband heard that, there was no problem. All his anger left. At which point his wife said, "Darling, I still need those eggs." But you know, sometimes with humour, I always wonder why people always laugh when I say that. Interesting part of humour. "Darling, I still need those eggs." And so off he went, got the eggs, abused all the way there, all the way back, never mattered because he knew the fellow was brain damaged. So, if people get angry at me, say bad things about me, that's all what I always think. It must be brain damaged. Why would you say bad and ugly things to a monk? So what that does, well, even though they've hit their head, you know, they must have hit their head, you know, that morning. Tell me, because all brain damage is temporary. So temporary brain damage, temporary insanity. That's what I call anger. And so just temporary insanity. So in other words, you don't take it seriously. You're giving it the benefit of the doubt. You're giving it some kindness, which means that it's not so hard and cutting. It softens everything. Ah, poor thing. Which means you can let it go easily. Oh, you made a mistake. Ah, you made a mistake. You know, you said the wrong thing. You did the wrong thing. Ah, come on. You know, just we all make mistakes. So don't feel so guilty about it. Give yourself the benefit of the doubt again. Which means that it gets softened. When you give kindness, understanding to the past, especially your mistakes, that means it softens and it's much easier to let it go. So we don't give ill will to the past. I'm going to get that person after this retreat. I know who he is. I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm, and we're going to get him blacklisted, never again on this retreat. They don't deserve to be on this retreat. That anger doesn't solve a problem. Kindness does. So the past, the future, we soften it with kindness. We're aware of it. We don't try and it didn't happen. It wasn't me. No, it was not in the right. It was you. Admit it, acknowledge it, be kind to it. And then it gets very soft and it disappears. So that's how we let go of the past and the future. Awareness and kindness working together, which means after a while the past is so soft, just like your body, just so relaxed, that it disappears. Which means you go into that next layer of petals, the present moment, right here. You know, it's wonderful to be here. Sometimes I feel like sending people a postcard when I'm on retreat, having a wonderful time, wish you were here. That means here, wherever you happen to be. Bah! You know, if you try and hold yourself in the present moment, stick to it, attach to it, again, it doesn't work. You're in the present moment because you let go of everything else. Renounce everything else. Abandon everything else. All that's left is the present moment. When you do that, it's just so easy to be with. At first, the present moment, you know, may be a bit sort of unstable, but you just have your mindfulness and the present moment and your kindness. And then it softens. It becomes a wonderful place to hang out. For those of you here for the first time, your room where you sleep at night and during the morning and the afternoon. You know, when you first go there, you have a really good night's sleep. This happens to me a lot because I travel around so much, different monasteries, even in Perth. Sometimes I sleep here, sometimes I sleep over in Bodhinyana, sometimes in Jhana Grove, sometimes in Dhammaloka, in Nolamara Center. I've got three bedrooms, even in around Perth, let alone when I go overseas. Sometimes you You can't. You sleep in a different bed every night when you're on tour. I know what just the Rolling Stones and the Beatles used to feel like. I'd do one night stands over through Indonesia and Singapore and Colombo. But anyway, when you go to a new bed, it's always just a bit uncomfortable. The first night is never comfortable. Not like your own bed. Because you've got to get used to it, first of all. You've got to get used to your pillow. And after a while, usually the second day, oh, it's not a bad sleep. The third day, it's just like being at home. It's your room. You recognize it. This is those stages which I call recognition, familiarity, and ease. Three stages. You recognize, and this is your room, you know where it is, you feel safe, you know the people next door, you know where the water is, you know how everything works. And so you recognize it, so that gives you a little bit of comfort. But then it's familiar, it's my old room, you know, you can recognize the blanket and you know whatever else you've got there. And then after the familiarity, it's like at ease. You can really relax and let go, you feel so safe. And that's with every one of these layers of petals. You recognize it, feel familiar, so you can just let go. You don't need to control it at all. Totally at ease. So that's like with the even the present moment. But sometimes, you know, people ask me, what is the present moment? What do you mean by it? They don't even know what to look for. So because of that, the recognition is really important, first of all. Ah, that's what you mean by the present moment. Why didn't you say that before? I did. But anyway, once you understand the present moment, it becomes familiar with it, and it's always there for you, wherever you go. Yeah, on an aircraft, in a shopping center, in the toilet, wherever you are, the present moment is always there. If you can recognize it and grab it and just be with it. So, and you're not afraid of it. That becomes that layer of petals called present moment. And just being here is just so wonderful. Don't have to worry about past or future. Oh, the past. Oh. The future, what's waiting for me? Oh. But the present moment is free. It's here. And what better present moment can you have than being with really good people, just meditating in Jhana Grove? Oh, this is beautiful food, nice people, relaxed, nothing to do, just being here. Oh, this doesn't get better than this. So, if you can't enjoy this, of course you can. Just be here. Don't be afraid of the happiness and the joy and the peace and the stillness. And just, if you want to do the exercise of present moment awareness, just like me, I've been advising many people, just go out to where the dining room is on the outside, nice, beautiful weather this season. Have a cup of tea or some orange juice or whatever's available and just sit out there. And I say, watch the trees grow. I say, watch the trees grow because sometimes people say, if I just say, just be here, do nothing, they say, well, what am I supposed to do? Nothing. But how do you do nothing? So sometimes it's a little trick. Just watch the trees grow. Oh, look at those trees. Okay, remember, be still. Yeah. You missed it. They grew. The trees do grow. We all know that. That's the truth. But you've got to really be still and focused to be able to watch a tree grow. You just turn around for 1 second, and this is an excuse to be still and to enjoy doing nothing. So, when you're in the present moment, it's a lovely place. You get used to it after a while and say, what am I supposed to do? Please, nothing. Just enjoy it. But why am I not supposed to improve? Stop that. Just be mindful, be kind. That's all. Even being mindful, being kind is just another excuse for doing nothing. What was that? It's amazing just how people are starting to understand meditation. That this woman said, "Oh, where's your husband this weekend?" "Oh, he's off at the meditation retreat in Jhana Grove." "Well, at least he's not at home sitting around doing nothing." If only she knew. So that after a while we start to enjoy the peace, doing nothing, not going anywhere, not trying to achieve anything, just being here. Because when you really get into the present moment, all the craving, the wanting, to want something means you have to have a perception of where you're going to go to, the future somewhere. To get angry, it's about something which happened in the past. But when the past and the future just all just fall off the radar, there's no wanting. There's no ill will or negativity, because you're right here. How can you be negative to this? And that's where that wonderful saying, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. That was a, I forget which philosopher that was, but that is just so Buddhist, so into meditation. When you want something more, you can't enjoy this moment. You've lost this moment. You've abandoned it for some promise of more happiness, more fulfillment, sometimes later on. You missed out for the present moment. So we don't want anything, we're just sitting here. But people say, well, you just sit here and do nothing, you won't get anywhere. Precisely. Why are you trying to get somewhere? But what happens, similar lotus really answers those questions. So you've got the present moment, quite a beautiful set of petals. And just mindful and kind, this present moment. Just relaxing with it. Just being aware, being kind, opening the door of your heart to this moment, just caring for it. It starts to open up. You start to see what's inside the present moment. Ooh, you know what that is? It is your breathing. That's what you become aware of, naturally. Reason is because your body is relaxed, you've let it go. Not really worrying about the past and the future, and it's also with the present moment, all of the thinking, the inner dialogue, most of that goes. And so inside the present moment, the only other thing which is moving is your breathing. The nature of the body, or nature of the brain and the mind, is only to watch things which move. If they're still, they vanish. Just like, that's a good example of that. Like the saliva in your throat. Now you can be aware of it, can't you? That's a problem. Control freaks. You don't be aware of it. And it stays stable, it just disappears by itself. What is still vanishes. The art of disappearing. So, after a while, the only thing left moving is the breath. And that's the best way of doing breath meditation. Let it come to you. Don't go capturing it. And that's what I do. As the breath comes in, oh, here you are again. And that layer of petals, breathing in, breathing out. What do I do next? Nothing. Just open the door of your heart, be aware, be kind to my breath. Be kind to my breath. Don't force it. Don't say, okay, it says in the suttas I should breathe long. I should breathe short. That was just so that you can have something to identify the breath with. This gives you a little handle on it. But a lot of times, you know, my breath is not long or short. It's sort of in between somewhere. So that really, so what am I supposed to do? It's not long, it's not short. Am I not following the Buddha's instructions? Of course you are. Just be aware of the breath. So I just sit there, just being aware of the breath in this moment. Just come to me, just being kind to it. Just being aware. And then That layer of petals opens up. The one inside is a full awareness of the breath. From the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. Because your mindfulness is getting stronger, it also means you're seeing more of the breath. Just like the simile of walking up the hillside, Kingsby Drive, when I started to slow down, I could see more blades of grass, more detail, because my mindfulness was increasing. Stillness, mindfulness, stillness, mindfulness. The two were working together so that when I'm very still, just being kind, watching this breath, you start to see much more of it. So you see 1,000 different feelings, sensations from the beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. It's not just in-out, in-out. Huge number of different experiences. Just like a person when you're doing walking meditation. After a while you get the full awareness of the feelings in the feet as you walk. Like a dancer just knows it's not just left, right. Thousands of different feelings and sensations. What part of your foot moves up from the ground first? What's the last part of your foot which separates from the floor? Does your foot go straight up? Or does it go zigzag this way all over the place? How does it move? When it gets to the top and you start to move forward, does it move like horizontal? Or does it go an arc or a big parabola? How does it move? Be aware of it. Don't control it. Don't interfere. Just like watch, impartially, like a experimental scientist. When it goes down, does it just drop straight down? Does it go forward a little bit, back a little bit, to the side? Does it twist around? What part of the foot touches the ground first? What last? Get aware of this incredible, all these feelings and sensations. Which means that you've got that stage of full awareness of the whole process. That's a very beautiful layer of petals, you're inside. And then it gets to the real juicy stuff. Because you've got full awareness of the breath. The breath becomes really gorgeous. These layer of petals, their scent is sometimes overwhelming. This is just my marketing, just to, you know, so you know, you say, oh yeah, I want this. So, and it is, it's a really beautiful, delightful breath. And sometimes you see people, they've got this delightful breath, that's a layer of petals, you don't get that through effort. You get that through wisdom, kindness, and mindfulness. It just happens. And then you're just really enjoying watching this breath come in, go out. Just by being by the beach, watching the waves come in, waves go out, not a care in the world. No signal for your iPhone or your tablets or whatever. Just waves coming in, waves going out. Oh, so relaxing, so restful. So why can I stay here forever? It's just so delightful. Nothing I want in the whole world. Content, watching the breath come in. The breath. Oh, so nice. So, really get into it. You get the delight. The joy and pleasure of meditation start to come. Second Satipatthana. Being aware of Vedana. According to the instructions of the Buddha. Joy. And this is when you're meditating here and it's time for lunch. No contest. You sit here and enjoy the meditation. It's so much nicer than lunch. And it's great when you see people doing that. It comes to 11 o'clock and they're still sitting here. Don't disturb them. Don't say, lunchtime, you've forgotten. No, don't disturb them. You can get lunch any time. But getting nice meditation that's more rare. So, enjoying a beautiful breath. So delightful, sitting here, hardly moving, because you're hardly moving. You don't need much oxygen, which means that the breath gets really smooth. And because the breath gets very smooth, it starts to disappear. When the breath disappears at that time, you think, what should I do? Breath disappeared. And you're back to the body and the stupid old mind. You've blown it. So don't go thinking like that. You're perfectly safe. You're not going to die or go crazy. I know that the BSWA has got insurance, but we never needed it. Actually, the only time we did need insurance, funny enough, was on one of the retreats during the hot season, the air condition stopped. You know why? It's because a cockroach had actually gone into the aircon and fried itself on the electronics. Poor cockroach. But you know that... I think the secretary, that's Leha, she said, oh, I'm going to claim on this on the insurance. And I said, you can't claim. You know, an act of cockroach, act of God I've seen before. Storms, but are we insured for suicidal cockroaches? But apparently it was covered and we got a payout for it. That was crazy. But anyway, just, you know, we thanked the cockroach and gave it a nice burial service somewhere, did we? It was already cremated. Anyway, but anyway, let's go back to reality. So anyway, so you're not going to die. You're sitting here and you feel you're not breathing. You are breathing, but it's very, very soft. And instead, that disappears. The delightful breath inside, the breath vanishes. Just the delight is left. The mind. The jitter. That is seen as this beautiful light which appears in the mind. The nimitta. Many people get those nimittas. So they're not really special, usually common or garden normal nimittas. So don't get excited. I'm only saying this to try and stop you getting excited. They are actually quite fantastic. But I don't want you to get too excited and just, I want. But they're very nice. And so what do you do with them? Just be aware and kind. Nothing more. And then they develop. And they get very bright, very beautiful. And then you're flying along in your meditation. Having a wonderful time. And then, as you come out from there afterwards, well, if you're lucky, you just go right into them and get jhanas and stuff. But you know that you've had a really good meditation. Because afterwards, wow, it's like you're walking on air. It's like you're just so high. It's like, like that fellow said, it's better than heroin. Not that I've ever had heroin, but I do remember doing this circumambulation once in this prison over in England. And we had a Buddha statue. We managed to get one into one of the prisons. Not smuggled, with approval and anything. A big Buddha statue with a nice little open prison, a nice little area for peace. And installing it, it was just really inspiring. So I was really getting high, just smiling. Oh, this is amazing. What a wonderful thing this is doing. And there was these two prisoners. They were looking at me through the... they were just waiting for the dinner coming afterwards, supplied by the Thai people. So they were only there for the meal. But they were still hanging out, having a look at what was going on. I caught two of them. They were looking at me and they pointed to me. And one said to the other, see that monk? He's on the gear. Which apparently means drugs. Because they thought that's the only way that anyone could be so happy. So that's what happens. You get really inspiration and it just feels so wonderful. That's brilliant. That's what's supposed to happen. So don't stop it. Just go deep into your lotus. You've got the beautiful petals in there, and you bless out. Oh, what a wonderful way of spending the Easter vacation. But where did you go when you go back home? Where do you spend Easter? In bliss. And what did you do? Well, I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And had nothing to eat in the evening. This works. So anyway, I'll go further into the lotus tomorrow, but it's about, it's just got 9 o'clock. So that's enough lotusing today. Sadhu. 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 Oh, it's nice to have a stretch. I'm enjoying this. Oh, very good. Okay, a few interviews.